Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Scott Kirshner.
The Oscar nominees were announced this morning. The dark frontier film The Revenant pulled in 12 nominations. Mad Max Fury Road received 10 nominations. Feels like the Academy seems to be honoring a lot of testosterone this year. So we're going to focus on an actor who's known for much quieter performances. He's British actor Mark Rylance. Star of the critically acclaimed television drama Wolf Hall, today Rylance received his first Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor for his performance as Soviet spy Rudolf Abel in Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies. The movie's set during the Cold War, and it tells the story of an American lawyer, played by Tom Hanks, who's recruited by the government to defend Abel in court. Rylance gives a performance that's both inscrutable and nihilistic, as we hear in this scene, where the two men take a moment to discuss the case's progress.
How did we do in there? Not too good. Apparently you're not an American citizen.
That's true.
And according to your boss, you're not a Soviet citizen either.
Well, the boss isn't always right. But he's always the boss.
Do you never worry?
Would it help?
Mark Rylance is currently in town performing his own play. It's called Nice Fish, in an American Repertory Theater production in Cambridge. He based the play on the prose poetry of Minnesota poet Louis Jenkins. Rylance also plays the character Ron, and the play is directed by his wife, Claire Van Kampen. We spoke with Van Kampen and Rylance a little earlier this month. And by the way, as an aside, they happened to visit our studios on Elvis's birthday, which we were celebrating with a special cake, and you'll hear about that in a second. But I began by asking Mark Rylance to tell us a little bit more about the inspiration for Nice Fish.
I was taken out ice fishing in Minneapolis when I was doing a production of Peer Gynt up there. And then I fell in love with the prose poetry of Louis Jenkins, who lives in Duluth, Minnesota. And I thought, oh, maybe these two things would go together, a bit like Elvis's birthday cake, which I see in your office outside here. What is it, banana cake?
Peanut butter frosting.
And that's bacon right. Bits on top.
Actually, it looks rather delicious. I might just get a little piece. I'm leaving.
Pauline would be happy to oblige, I'm sure.
Happy birthday, Elvis.
Happy birthday, Elvis.
So these two things you felt would go together well. And you were inspired while ice fishing yourself, did you say?
I was taken ice fishing.
Yes,
I grew up in, I'm English, but I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I've always had a certain nostalgic love of cold weather and snow and ice. But I was taken out ice fishing and was very taken by the whole experience of sitting in a little wooden shack at 5 a.m. in the morning. But the whole thing just was a very poetic setting. So I wanted to make a play about two fellas out ice fishing.
It does lend itself, I should say, to a very contemplative feel, just even describing, as you're describing, the setting of...
There's not a lot else you can do, no.
No, when it's 20 below.
Right.
Sitting out there.
Well, I was seeing that the play basically has that structure of two ice fishermen on the ice waiting. In a way, the word waiting makes me think it has a very Waiting for Godot feel.
On ice
to it, too. But how much of the actual poetry is in the play?
So Lewis is a prose poet.
A prose poet, okay.
And I was given some awards on Broadway when I was in a couple of plays there in 2008 and another occasion, I think 2012 or 11. And rather than just thank a lot of people that no one knew who I was thanking, I spoke to these prose poems as my acceptance speech.
Rylance used Jenkins' prose poetry for his award speeches twice, in 2008, as he said, and again in 2011 when he won a Tony for his role in Jerusalem.
I've lost my hat and torn my jacket in a lot of fences. The best approach to a wall is first two hands flat against the wall. You'll feel the dry inner surface, then there's a moment of total darkness before you step through on the other side. Thanks very much.
And I was very struck that people thought I was saying my own words, that they didn't think they were poems. So I could see that they were that they could be dialogue. And so I've made the play with Claire's help and the whole help of the cast and Louis Jenkins, who's in the play as well. we've made the play together out of the 500 or 600 poems he's written.
Mark's been really rather modest about it because...
Why am I not surprised?
Yes, he has achieved quite a magical feat of making a play out of poems. Obviously, there's been a precedent, the great Shakespeare himself. But this is an extraordinary thing because after a while, when you're listening to the play, you've forgotten that you're listening to poetry. Mm-hmm. You're just involved in the story. So it's been very cleverly put together and made into a narrative, a very exciting narrative about what happens to two fishermen one day when they decide to go ice fishing together and something strange happens on the ice.
So tell me about the experience directing this play then. I mean, since you were part of its creation from
the
beginning.
Yes, well, very lucky to be able to, first of all, co-direct it with Mark when we did it at the Guthrie. It gave its first outing.
And this was a couple of years
this
ago,
This was a
right?
couple of years back in 2013. And in actual fact, we decided to take the cast out ice fishing. And I made them rehearse on the ice. So they got a really good taste of what it was like to be out there for 4 solid hours in all their clothes, actually doing scenes from the play.
Yeah, I think you went and sat in the car.
I kept myself warm. But this time I have a little bit more of a lead role in terms of the direction, but I have to say it's a very communal effort, the way we work.
So I hope I'm not putting you on the spot. Can you give us a little feel of the text?
When you're in town, wearing some kind of uniform is helpful. Policeman, priest, etc. Driving a tank is very impressive, or a car with official lettering on the side. If that isn't your taste, you could join the revolution, wear an armband, carry a homemade flag tied to a broom handle, or a placard bearing an incendiary slogan. At the very least, you should wear a suit and carry a briefcase and a cell phone, or wear a team jacket, a baseball cap, and carry a cell phone. Now, if you go into the woods, the back country, someplace past all human habitation, it's a good idea to wear orange and carry a gun, or, depending on the season, a fishing pole or a camera with a big lens. Otherwise, it might appear that you have no idea what you're doing, that you're just wandering the earth, no particular reason for being here, no particular place to go.
That's Mark Rylance giving us a fabulous little taste from the play Nice Fish. Is it inappropriate for me to say I was totally captivated by hearing you say that just here across the desk
from
me?
It's very appropriate.
It's appropriate?
I was. Yes.
So can you tell me, for a play like this, how does it feel different versus, say, the screen work that you've done?
I have thought up a clever answer for this question. I can't remember it now. I mean, it's still, you're telling a story, you know, and the thing is, we both were lucky enough to work at Sam Wanamaker's reconstruction of the Globe Theatre in London. Mm-hmm. And the big thing the Globe Theatre taught us was that the stage is in the middle of the circle, and the circle includes the actors and the audience. We're in one room, and that's really become the main thing for me since I work there, is that every piece of theatre I make, I want the audience to be in the same room with me. So if you went to see Julius Caesar, for example, you're not looking at a display of how Brutus and Cassius and all those assassins killed Julius Caesar. You're in the room with them. I always used to say to the actors of the Globe, don't talk to the audience or for them or at them. Talk with them. Mm-hmm. To be or not to be, that's the question. You know, do you agree? Do you have a different question that's more important than that question? What do you think? So not only in the same room, in the same time.
Just from an outsider's perspective, because I've been watching Mark's acting since 1986 or 87 now, so a long time, I don't know many actors who can establish that sense of intimacy with an audience so very quickly and sustain that. So I feel that he would be far too modest to say so, but I feel that audiences have a unique connection to him on stage, that they feel they know him, that they are in a conversation with him. And looking at how he translates that ability to working with the camera is that he does that with a camera, in that he lets the camera inside.
And nowhere is this more evident than in Mark Rylance's critically acclaimed performance in Wolf Hall, the BBC adaptation of Hilary Mantel's best-selling books about politics and intrigue in the court of Henry VIII. Wolf Hall just won a Golden Globe for Best Limited Series, and in it, Rylance plays Thomas Cromwell, the English lawyer of humble birth who becomes chief minister to the Tudor king. Rylance is in almost every shot, and sometimes his face betrays only a ripple of the oceans of emotion and political calculus spinning in Cromwell's mind. You can really feel it in this scene where Cromwell visits an impatient Anne Boleyn, played by Claire Foy.
No one's more distressed than the cardinal that the king cannot have his heart's desire, which was ever the cardinal's desire too. He knows that all the king's subjects repose their hopes in you for an heir to the throne.
Very nice. Very nice, Master Cromwell. But try again. One simple thing we asked of the cardinal, and he would not.
You know it wasn't simple.
Well, perhaps I'm a simple person. Do you feel I am?
You may be. I hardly know you.
Can I ask you about Wolf Hall a little bit? Because the way Claire was describing what you do, because I feel like the emotional intelligence and the emotional force of that entire series is communicated through your face in just about every scene. And I just want to know what that experience was like. How did you do that?
Well, you know, it's really Hilary Mantel who wrote the book who did it, because someone would say to Cromwell, would you like some cheese on your bread? And about six pages later, he'd say, maybe another time, having considered where the bread came from, why cheese was made, and why cheese was a bit like Anne Boleyn, and why she wasn't like that. And, you know, pages and pages of him thinking before he would then mutter something very minimal. And in other places, she described him as the one in the room that looks like a wall.
Mm.
So it was a matter of me just trying to think as much of those six pages before I answered the question.
But well, because you did what Claire was describing, like letting the camera in.
Well, all I did was just think and tried not to, you know, mug and make expressions to show I was thinking, but be confident that I was just... Well, that's the difficult thing, to be confident that your thinking will register. And I gathered confidence that, oh, I can just really Robert Mitchum this one out. And I can just, you know, and I watched a lot of Robert Mitchum films before doing it.
But there's a risk, though. I mean, I completely understand in the context of the novel, having six pages pass, because we're let in through Hilary Mantel's writing into the thought process and the emotional tumult that's going on within Cromwell. But to have to cross that span in a short period of time on film and have that writing be evident on your face... If we can't be let in as viewers to Cromwell's internal life, there's no story.
There's no story. That is the story.
Yes.
That's definitely the story of the book, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're right to say the brilliant thing is that the cast around is so great that I could do very little, and they were generating the drama.
I mean, Damian Lewis as Henry and Claire Foy as Anne Boleyn, they were just like incandescent on the screen.
So yes. Childlike, yeah. Weren't
wonderful.
They?
Yeah.
Smart, in her case. My God, suddenly realizing that you're working for a sociopath, really, or a psychopath. Not a psychopath, but a sociopath. Realizing gradually, oh my God, this king that God has granted us as a nation, and therefore we can't doubt it, he's really unwell.
Well... Have you done work at the ART before?
Yeah, we did. Okay. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, 1991... I played Hamlet here, and Claire wrote the music for that production, and I played Constantine and the Seagull as well. It was a two-show deal.
Oh, but so it's been some time, though.
Yes.
Oh, it's great to
Nearly
have you 25, back then.
25 years.
Yeah. Okay.
Mark Rylance, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Pleasure.
And Claire Van Kampen, a great pleasure to speak with you as well. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Lovely to speak with you too.
And thank you to both of you for bringing Nice Fish to the ART in Cambridge.
Hope you enjoy it.
ART's production of Nice Fish opens in Cambridge this Sunday. It will run through February 7th. We've got more information about it at radioboston.org. And we're going to go out today on some music from Wolf Hall, accurate to the early 16th century. It was researched and arranged by Claire Van Kampen.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Scott Kersner. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.